Miriam Elder knows something about settling down in Russia. She reported there for 7 years, most recently as the Moscow correspondent for The Guardian. She's now back in the States, starting work as the foreign editor of BuzzFeed. She says if Snowden does stay in Russia, he may be surprised by life there.
He's about to enter a world that's unlike anything he's known before, having lived in the U.S. his whole life.
In what way? What are the kind of bullet points for him?
Well, I saw that his lawyer brought him a copy of some Dostoevsky and Chekhov books, but I would recommend he read people like Gogol and Saltykov-Shchedrin, these famous Russian satirists, because one of the main things in Russia is just the absurdity of life, and those are authors that broach that topic really well. I would tell him to always carry around a lot of change with him because no shopkeepers ever have any change. And something that he probably thought of himself, I would tell him never to talk about anything sensitive on the phone or over email because every foreigner living in Russia just assumes that they're being listened to.
On the subject of the government, on the one hand, Vladimir Putin likes to take every opportunity to bash the U.S. for its double standard. Is Snowden an opportunity for him in this regard?
Absolutely. Russia's positioning itself now under Putin in a sort of similar way that it did during the Cold War, which is it just opposes anything the West does. So even though Putin has, you know, made a few statements saying, oh, we don't really want this guy here, I suspect that there is a degree of gloating going on inside the Russian government.
So you were in Russia for 7 years. You covered a lot of different issues there. I wonder for you, what stories stick out the most?
There are two things that are interrelated. Russia just kind of blew up into protest, these middle-class young protests last year when Putin was getting ready to return to the presidency. And that was so unexpected. I'd lived with like an apathetic populace for so long. To see so many people caring was almost emotional. And then the flip side to that was, I would say, the trial against Pussy Riot, because that was the first time that we really saw the government start to crack down on these people. And it was, you know, this female punk band that went through a horrible trial and is now in prison. And it was just kind of the beginning of this crackdown that is still ongoing.
Was there a moment from that trial that really stays with you?
Yeah, I actually just rewatched the video of this the other day that I took inside the courtroom. And the three women are being led from the cage that they were being held in during the trial, and they're handcuffed and being led by armed guards. And there's this massive Rottweiler. And just as they start walking by, it starts barking like crazy, jumping at them. The guard has to really hold this dog back from tearing them to bits. And it was just such a powerful image. These three women who are really, musicians in one sense, but more than anything, they're just punks. And just to see them facing Russian justice and all its absurdity embodied by this black Rottweiler was really powerful.
Miriam, you spent a lot of days in the courtroom covering the Pussy Riot's case and covering the case of the Russian political opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, and so many other things. It can get pretty heavy. Do you think your time in Russia covering such kind of tough stories has shaped your worldview?
Oh, yeah, I think it's inevitable that it has. Being in Russia makes you a much tougher person. In a way, it makes you a much more cynical person. Sitting in these courtrooms and listening and watching this imitation of justice.
What about sort of daily life living there? Besides the stories you're covering, what's the kind of rhythm of life that you're dealing with?
Moscow is a very hard place to live. It has its beauties, but it's hard to get anything done. It's hard to even to cross the street. You know, like you don't really cross the street overground. You have to find these tunnels that are underground. It's a place that like rewards somebody who really, really knows it, but it takes a long time to get to know.
How about your friendships with Russians? Were you able to make strong friendships there?
It's kind of a cliche, but I think it's because it's true that friendships in Russia are so much stronger and so much deeper and just so much more familial than anything that I've ever seen in the West.
Did they feel a sense, I mean, betrayal is too strong a word, but did they feel a sense of, no, you can't leave, that they're kind of losing you forever?
Nobody ever really leaves Russia. I'm in touch with foreign correspondents who worked there in the 80s. They still come back regularly. It's a place that grabs onto you and doesn't really let you go, and you don't want to let go.
I understand you had a pretty heartwarming goodbye party.
Yeah, there were some really sweet moments. We were in this bar at one point, and everybody took turns standing up on a table and saying toasts. I mean, this is part of the beauty of Russia, is that everything takes on this grand meaning. So it wasn't just toasts, you know, to, oh, Miriam, you know, have a great time when you leave. It was, we will make Russia free so that you can come back here with your children. It was just all very meaningful and profound and very moving.
You know, your time in Russia has really coincided with the rise of social media, and you really jumped into that. You've been really prolific on Twitter and Instagram. How did those tools help you in reporting on Russia?
It's just there's some things you can't put into your stories. You know, I can't put in like the ridiculous things that cab drivers say to me, asking me if I'm a Jew or a certain slur that I won't mention. And these are like little one-liners that I can just throw on Twitter to show just how ubiquitous the absurdity and the ridiculousness is. Like, you can't leave your house without something utterly ridiculous happening to you. I'm not going to write an article about it every time. I'll just, you know, take out my phone and send it out there on Twitter.
Now, you've been back in the U.S. for just a few days. You've just been recounting the difficulties of living in Russia. But are there a couple things you're worried about being back in the U.S., about reentering life here?
I'm really worried about my smoking habit because
that's a big no-no here now.
It's not just a big no-no. It's just so expensive. You know, in Russia, a pack of cigarettes costs like not even $2. I paid $13 in New York yesterday, which I know is the right thing to do, but it's going to be difficult to get used to.
What will you miss most about life in Moscow? I mean, you've talked about the beauty and unpredictability, but is there an aspect of covering a country like that as a journalist that is sort of invigorating?
You're driven in Moscow by adrenaline to a large degree. So things will be sort of quiet, quiet, quiet. And then all of a sudden, Snowden will land in Sheremetyevo, or Moscow will erupt in protest and not go home for months. And you just find yourself not sleeping. And these are the things that happen in a country that is still changing and still developing. That's something I feel like doesn't happen here as much.
Former Russian correspondent for The Guardian, Miriam Elder. Look forward to hearing what you're going to talk about now that you're back in the U.S. Thanks, Miriam.
Thank you.